Well, here we are once again, another Sabbath day, another chance to look into God's Word and see what He has in mind for us. I'm not going to tell you something you didn't know by saying that He gave instructions to His followers to go into all the world and preach the gospel. In the past, we've sort of relegated that activity largely to the ministry. But let's keep in mind that being His disciples, that extends to any one of us. Going into the world, and that's outside of here, and presenting God's truth to those people, at least, who will hear it. We tend to shy away. Our history in WCG or whatever sort of left it to the professionals. The people in general didn't delve into that all that much, not personally. We preach the gospel collectively, certainly. Look at what we're doing. I mean, we've got all kinds of literature. We're on the web. We're on YouTube. We're supporting group works in Africa. We have the radio broadcast. And we have an open invitation to those who want to attend with us. So collectively, we're doing part of it anyway. But what about where it applies to each of us? Let's look at 1 Corinthians 4:1. 1 Corinthians 4, verse 1. And this is kind of personal, where it says, "Let a man so account of us as of the ministers of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God." Being enlightened, being given the ability to see things that the general public can't see, makes us stewards of what we understand. In 1 Peter 3:15, 1 Peter 3:15, it says, "But sanctify the Lord God in your hearts, and be ready always to give an answer to every man that asks you a reason of the hope that is in you with meekness and fear." People are going to notice things. You've probably had that happen to you. They're going to notice something. You may not be able to put their finger on it exactly, but they're going to notice, and they're going to ask. Not necessarily anything profound, nor does the answer necessarily need to be anything profound. But it's important to sense what they see in you, what they're asking about, and to lead into a conversation where we can represent that hope that is within us. In John 4:35 is that well-known passage. And it's always true. It's as much true today, and maybe even more so than it was in the first century. 4:35. "Say you not, there are yet 4 months, and then comes the harvest." And that particular passage tends to place this in the time frame of Pentecost. Just a side point. But he says, "Behold, I say unto you, lift up your eyes." Wake up. Look around. "Look unto the fields, for they are white already to harvest. And he that reaps receives wages." There's a benefit to this. "And gathereth fruit unto the eternal that both he that sows and he that reaps may rejoice together. It shows somewhat of a collaborative effort where one individual plants a seed, and that individual, or someone else even, might ultimately reap the harvest. Now think of Christ as being the reaper in this case. Where does that leave us? That leaves us with the obligation, to the best of our ability, to plant that seed. Now, the world today is white unto harvest, particularly in our culture, because so much of the general public has been at least acquainted with Christian principles, Christian teachings. There's all kinds of churches in the world, and each one has its own little element of truth and measures of things that aren't true. But the point is, there is a familiarity today in our environment that they didn't have back in the first century. I would say the fields today are whiter than ever before. But the problem is how to bring that harvest into the fold. The problem is, how do we do that? How do we do it effectively? How do we bring the gospel message to people that have a general awareness, but they don't really get the specifics? They don't really understand. There is a certain preparation, we could say, in the awareness of many people, where the right thing said at the right time could bring them around to an understanding that they didn't necessarily have before. Pam related an issue to me some time ago where one of her elderly, card players or whatever, bridge players, was worried about her relatives because they weren't converted. She thought, anyway. And Pam had to explain to her that people will be called in their time. Not everyone is destined to be called now. And this woman was kind of set back by that because she, 70 years of her adult life attending church, she never heard anything like that. Now, we understand it, but she did not. And to her credit, she went and asked around and looked it up and found out Pam was right, that not everyone is destined to be called now. And thus, we don't need to necessarily worry about all the others whose day is set for a later time. God will call everyone eventually. But right now, there is two harvest periods. There is the harvest of first fruits that is coming, and there is a greater harvest to follow. The world doesn't understand that, but here was a key to get into someone's thought processes where she could begin to understand the bigger picture. And we can all do that in certain ways. We don't have to try and convert everybody right from the get-go. But they're going to notice things about us. Particularly, they're going to notice that we're going out the door every Saturday morning dressed in our best. They're going to ask. What are they going to ask? Who knows? But we need to be ready to give an account, like it says. What do we say? When someone asks you about your belief system, what do you say? Think about it. What would you say first? How would you present your belief system being any different than anyone else's? I know what most of us do, and it's an easy thing to fall into, but we would throw out there Sabbath and holy days. Oh, like that's the big deal. Let's understand something about the environment, the religious environment that we live in. We live in a world that is biased in many important ways. And I've told others this story, but a friend of my mother's, We used to drive her to church every Sunday down the road. Mrs. Zeiler. Back in the 70s, early 70s, she was listening to Garner Ted on the radio. Loved it. Couldn't get enough of Garner Ted. Loved his preaching. Loved all the things he did. Until one day, he said something about the biblical holy days. She was gone. No further interest. We need to understand that in this world, there is a bias against Old Testament beliefs and practices. And we need to approach people who have grown up in the religious environment of this world with that understanding in mind. There is that anti-Jewish bias. It's deeply embedded in most of the Protestant world, and I would suspect the Catholic world. So what would we say to someone who's asking what is different, what is unique, what is relevant about your belief system as opposed to anyone else's? I'm going to throw out some suggestions, and maybe in the future, should such a situation arise, we might be able to use these as opposed to the other one, realizing the reaction that it might get on the other person. Well, we could explain to them that we understand about the 1,000-year millennial kingdom on earth. Now, there's a difference, and there's plenty of scriptures that'll back that up that would come to mind should there be opportunity to pursue that further. Because the Protestant world, for the most part, is talking about going to heaven. They're going to spend eternity in heaven. What need is there for a 1,000-year reign of Christ on the earth? What's he going to be doing? There is so much that we could use to expand upon that about his overall plan. We could explain that we understand the true nature of God, the dual person Godhead. And that should spark conversation among those who would be willing to pursue that. Because most are oriented to either a Trinitarian thinking or a strict monotheistic thinking where there's but one being that's God. So there's room for productive conversation should the other person be interested in pursuing specifics. We could explain that we understand the resurrections. And in this religious climate, that's a big one. Because if people die and spend eternity in either place, what need is there for any resurrections? Do you see how you can expand the conversation into productive areas without necessarily turning someone off? It's so easy to do. We could explain the two harvests of humanity, and we've touched on that here with Pam's encounter, that not everyone is being called to the first harvest, and most people have never heard about any other harvest. They understand the event that's going to happen with the resurrection of the saints and the physical change of those living from flesh to spirit at Christ's second coming. But what about another resurrection beyond that, the one that's after the 1,000 years that you read of in Revelation 20? Another beautiful area for conversation if we want to lead someone into an understanding of the differences between what we understand and what the religious world in general understands. We could explain the prophetic fulfillment of the second coming. What's going to happen? Protestants who think God's going to grab all his people, take them up to heaven, and who knows what after that. What about all the rest that are left? The majority who are not converted. What happens with all of them? We have an answer. They have a question. Can you see where we could go with that? What about the lake of fire? We could explain the lake of fire because that's different from the concept of an ever-burning hell. It might prove interesting to someone who's worried about their destiny. And that's another one. We could explain the human destiny. What is humanity created for anyway? What is all this? All these people for all generations. I mean, wars and all kinds of horrible events. What's it all for? Why did God make humanity in the first place? It could be a productive conversation without turning someone off. That's the important thing that we have to sense. Where is the other person coming from? What is their background? What is their understanding? Because we need to address things in a way that doesn't turn them off, but that intrigues them to ask more questions. And hopefully they will. We could explain the indwelling of God's Spirit. I don't know that the general religious public focuses much on that. They talk about being led by God's Spirit. Well, fine. But what about the personal indwelling of that Spirit? Depending on the person, we could explain, we understand the identity of the 10 tribes and their place in prophecy. Depending on the person, that might be an intriguing area of conversation. We could explain what really happens at death, because this world doesn't know. It has other ideas. When a person dies, what is their state? We could explain about the judgments. There's more than one. What are they for? And what happens? Is there a time when sheep are separated from the goats? Try to get an average Protestant to explain when and how that happens and why it happens. Sheep from the goats. They're two different categories of people assigned to two different destinies. Could we explain that? Or could we get them to understand that there is something a little more than is taught in your average religious organization? If someone is really receptive, we could maybe walk through Hebrews 6, fundamentals. Each of those is an area of conversation that would be profitable to anyone who doesn't understand the process of conversion and the ultimate destiny of a human being. We could talk about being called. When is a person called? How do we know they're being called? Because they might ask them of themselves. They might have thought that they were themselves called. We could explain what eternal life involves. What would the explanation be of your average churchgoers about that? I've sort of mentioned this already, but let's focus on it a little more specifically. And you'll hear the term legalism. That's legalism. Now, that might be the reaction if we just throw out up front the Sabbath and holy days to your average religious person. Legalism. We don't need to do that. That's all done away. The law is all done away. Anything that comes from the law, you can ignore that. That's the average point of view of people who have been brought up in the average Protestant culture. They think that that is our effort to earn salvation. That's their out. That's how they would justify dismissing the idea of keeping the law. We don't need to keep the law, they would say. So you can see there's an important and a sensitive area that we need to be attentive to know where they're coming from. How do we counter that? In Matthew 10:16, it kind of gives us a general approach. Matthew 10, verse 16. And he's talking to us here, as much as anyone else. Behold, I send you forth as sheep in the midst of wolves. You see, when we walk into this kind of environment, when we try and talk to someone who has other religious beliefs, there can be a rather nasty reaction. It's important that we sense the situation and know how to approach it in the most effective way. Behold, I send you as sheep in the midst of wolves. Be you therefore wise as serpents and harmless as doves. That involves a very careful balancing act to sense the other person's reaction, to realize what they're receptive to and what they're not receptive to, and to know how to guide the conversation in a manner where you can keep it going and at least give them the picture of the truth, of the hope that we have, of the understanding that we have. That's how it needs to be done. That's the approach. We can be combative. That's easy to do. I always tell people that want to be somebody close at home wants to be confrontive on situations. I say to her, it's easy to pick a fight. Very easy to pick a fight. It's one of the easiest things to do. But to know how to steer the situation in a productive way, that's what we're called to do. A basic approach that we could acquaint people with is the basic definition of love that Jesus Christ himself gave. If you love me, keep my commandments. That's not hard to understand. Problem is, the commandments are in the Old Testament, and the world reacts rather negatively to many Old Testament teachings. They want to change it for him to be meaning, oh, only those commandments that he gave, as though the other commandments were given by some harsh old God of the Old Testament. Little do they know that they were one and the same, but that's a whole different argument. But if you love me, keep my commandments. What's hard to understand about that? Well, basically one commandment's the problem, and I think we know what that one is. I mean, nobody's advocating murder or theft or adultery or any of those things. And Jesus spoke of those things himself, when he was asked. So it's an easy conversation to have, and it shouldn't be that reactive of the other side to say, if you love God, keep his commandments. That's a good door into the area of reacting against Old Testament teachings. The love of God is exhibited in commandment keeping. A lot of people prefer to exhibit their love for God with pure emotionalism. And if you've been in the Protestant world, you'll recognize that kind of thing. Pure emotionalism. That's how they love God. And to some degree, that's appropriate, but when it's just emotion and not understanding, not knowledge, with no clue as to what God is doing, that becomes different. And no clue as to what God requires of us as far as response and how we live our lives. Emotion alone is not going to do it. So that's another thing we have to counter and work around, to inject a little bit of practical understanding as well. Let's understand that a lot of these people who we might consider ripening for harvest, and I'm sure that's the field where there are the most likely prospects for gaining an understanding, is in the people who have already been brought up to some degree in the religions of this world. They have grown up, unfortunately, in what we could regard as contaminated soil. They've grown to a point, but their root structure is in something that is false, and we have to discern what is false and what we can put into their a field of understanding that would bring them from that state into better soil. What is the soil? Where is the soil? In Matthew 13, we have a wonderful description of this whole subject. Matthew 13, 3, "And he spoke many things unto them in parables, saying, Behold, a sower went forth to sow." Put yourself in that picture. "And when he sowed, some seeds fell by the wayside, and the fowls came and devoured them up. Some fell upon stony places, where they had not much earth, and forthwith they sprang up, because they had no depthness of earth. And when the sun was up, they were scorched, and because they had no root, they withered away." We can compare these situations to what happens with people who are exposed to the truth. And I'm sure that's his point. "And some fell among thorns, and the thorns sprang up and choked them. But other fell into good ground and brought forth fruit, some 100-fold, some 60-fold, some 30. Who has ears to hear, let him hear." The next few verses explains why he was speaking to them in parables. I think we understand that. But let's go down to verse 17. And this too applies to us, because he was speaking to his disciples who understood things to a degree that religious people, even the prophets, desired to understand and didn't. What made the difference? The difference was the enlightenment that God's Spirit gave them. "For verily I say unto you, that many prophets and righteous men have desired to see those things which you see and have not seen them, and to hear those things which you hear and have not heard." Then he goes on in verse 18 to explain the parable of the sower. And I want to change the environment. We're tending to think of the world, the fields, actual fields. Let's consider it as a spiritual environment that exists within the fellowship of faith. So he says, "Hear, therefore, let me explain to you the parable of the sower. When anyone hears the word of the kingdom and understands it not, then comes the wicked one and catches away that which was sown in his heart. This is he which receives seed by the wayside." A lot of truth is put out there. People hear it. They understand to a point. But somehow, there is a spiritual overwhelming that blanks out what they understand to the point where they can't. "It catches away that which was sown in his heart. This is he which received seed by the wayside." Just what gets lost along the path. "But he that receives seed unto stony places, the same is he that hears the word, and anon with joy receives it." They love what they're hearing. Can't get enough of it. "But their root is among stones." Back east, we had a major quarry. And that quarry produced a kind of stone that was used for railroad ballast. And I don't know if the term is used out here, but back east, it's called trap rock. It's a kind of stone that has no soil within it. It's sort of like ground up granite. It's just, in fact, it's even harder than granite. But it was trap rock. And I wonder if trap rock might be a good comparison to this stony ground. The roots can go down amongst the stones and seek nutrients, and there's nothing there. Nothing can grow in it. And that's why they use it. But here's a comparison. Stony ground. But he that received the seed into stony places, the same as he that hears the word, and anon with joy receives it. Very positive response from the person. But they can't endure because something's missing. Verse 22, he also that received seed among the thorns is he that hears the word with equal enthusiasm perhaps. But the cares of this world and the deceitfulness of riches choke the word, and he becomes unfruitful. That happens, unfortunately. But 23, but he that receives seed unto the good ground is he that hears the word and understands it, which also bears fruit and brings forth some 100-fold, some 60, some 30. These are the conditions that we unfortunately must expect. That's what's going to happen. Not everyone is destined to find their way into good soil. But I had another thought about this passage. Let's ask, where is the stony ground? Is it out there in the world? I mean, they're already living out there in the world. Where is that stony ground? They hear the word, they respond positively to it, but they have no root. Something doesn't quite work to nourish them as a healthy plant. Where is that stony ground? Can it be within the congregation? Can a congregation provide stony ground to the potential growth of someone who hears and responds positively to the truth? Have we thought about that? Now, on the other hand, the good soil, where would the good soil exist? Would it be a person living out in the world on their own? Religious, yes, but not necessarily fellowshipping anywhere? Would that be the good soil for spiritual growth? You know, we would expect that it would be within the congregation. That's where you want to find the good soil. So there's a question we need to ask ourselves. And I'll let that be enough. Further on in the chapter, he goes on to explain something else that we need to understand, and perhaps it's relevant more so than we think. But in verse 24, another parable put he forth unto them, saying, and this again is still in Matthew, what is it, 13 we were in? Another parable he put forth unto them, saying, the kingdom of heaven is like unto a man which sowed good seed in his field. But while men slept, the enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat and went his way. Snuck in, scattered some other seed, commingled, and he disappeared. But when the blade was sprung up and brought forth fruit, I mean, it wasn't discernible while the plants were young, but as the heads began to develop to the point where they were obviously bringing forth fruit or not, but when they were bringing forth fruit, then appeared the tares also. It became obvious, the two, but at a certain point in growth. So his servants of the householder came and said to him, sir, didn't you sow good seed in the field? Where do these tares come from? And he said unto them, an enemy has done this. The servant said unto him, will you then that we go and gather them up? You would think that would be a massive undertaking in a field to select out the tares and pull them up just to keep the good wheat. Here's the instruction he gave them in that situation. But he said to them, no, lest while you gather up the tares, you root up also the wheat with them. Let both grow together until the harvest. And in the time of harvest, I will say to the reapers, gather you together first the tares and bind them in bundles to burn them, but gather the wheat into my barn. That is rather profound when you think it through. What is he saying? What are the implications? Where would that apply in our situation? One thing we could say to people who are asking about our religious beliefs is we could say to them, we follow the beliefs and practices of the early New Testament church. They think they do too. So there's areas where we could point out the differences. The early New Testament church had a belief system that is explained in the New Testament very clearly that is different than what you find in many common accepted religious systems. Think about your own early soil, okay, when you were called. What attracted you? What caught your attention? What made you stop and listen a little further along? I know in my case, my first introduction to the truth was in the late 60s. I'm sorry, no, early 60s. Hearing the broadcast on the radio. Something there drew my attention. I can't tell you now what it was back then, as many, many years ago. But the truth has a ring to it. And this will occur with anyone who has an interest in God's word, in God's truth, in God's way of life. The truth has a ring to it. God's Spirit will ring that bell. Okay? And when we see that happening, we're in a position where we're obligated to carry it further. Not the cop out, but we need to do so with all of the wisdom that we can muster. There is a field white unto harvest. He can see it. Whether we can or not remains to be seen. But he can see it. Anyone in business expecting to sell their product to a customer, if they're ever going to be successful, they need to know how to package their deal to present to people in a way that will appeal to them. And maybe that's the gist of what I'm trying to say today. We don't just throw out things that appeal to us personally that might be a turnoff to others. There is a bias against Old Testament practices and teachings. Some churches acknowledge the New Testament only. They don't even have them in their pews. No need for the Old Testament as far as they see it. We need to understand that that is a component, that is a reaction that you're going to run into. But there is so much in the New Testament that is sufficient to lead the conversation. And that takes some certain skill. But we need to know how to package the product that we're trying to sell. Find the topics to present that draw the person's interest. Not everyone is interested in the same thing. Not everyone is interested in what we're interested in. Find what they're interested in. What's the right day to bring the the Sabbath and holy days into the conversation? It takes some discernment. I wouldn't put that up front, which is so easy to do. We bring that in at the right time and in the right place, with the realization that the environment that they've grown up in is negatively reacted to those things. True, right, good, yes. But it's not appropriate in every situation. I've given you a whole list of other things that we could bring the conversation into that might lead a person to a better understanding of God's plan for mankind. How do we bring in the holy days? Well, after we've covered the subject of God's plan for mankind, then we can explain that the holy days illustrate the two harvest periods, the harvests of humanity. Okay? If we present the holy days in that context, can you see the difference in the response that might be? Each of us, anytime we represent God's truth to the world, to anyone, to a friend, to an acquaintance, to a relative, anytime that we relate the truth, we're planting a seed. That seed may not grow to its fullness in this age, but we're planting a seed. And if we're going to grow a crop, we need to provide a proper soil, a soil that is amended sufficiently where their root system can grow in it. You know, we're trying to grow certain kind of flowers around our house, and we find out that in that area that we've cleared, they used to be Russian knapweed. If you're familiar with those, the root structure of those plants poisoned the soil. Looks beautiful soil, nice. But nothing will grow in it, not with any vigor. Okay? Certain environments that people have grown up in were in poisoned soil. We need to know how to amend the soil in a way where they can take root. Let's understand, we are all going to stand before the judgment seat. I don't know if we think about that as thoroughly as we ought to. Let's go to Romans 14. Because this is a fundamental truth. Romans 14, verse 12. Back up to verse 11. For it is written, as I live, says the Lord, every knee shall bow to me, and every tongue shall confess to God, so that every one of us shall give account of himself to God. We're going to have to stand at some point in time before God, and he's going to ask, what have you done for me? What are you going to say? If he reminds us that there was a person in your life that I was thinking of calling, they might have been a good prospect for conversion in this age. I was looking to them. And I was expecting you to plant a seed. And for some reason, you copped out. How does that accrue to our account? How do we know that some person that we know, that we interact with, who is on the verge of asking a question but doesn't really follow through, we might have to goad that question to come forth a little bit? How do we know? Maybe God has someone in mind that he might have called, except for our failure to present the truth as we understand it. When we stand in that place, and this is not the same judgment as the final judgment. This is a different judgment. There is going to be what some people refer to as the Bema seat. I don't know if you've ever heard that term. But it's like the awards ceremony of those people who have been brought into the spirit dimension at Christ's second coming. There is going to be a type of judgment seat for the converted. Some are going to be rewarded differently. Those that produce a great deal are going to get a better reward. There's a reward involved here. Some people who only did minimum, they're okay, they're in, but their reward is less. And we could say there's people who buried their talent rather than used it at all. What of them? That's the rewards ceremony that it's talking about. We're going to stand before God and He's going to say, "What have you done for me?" How would we answer that? How would we answer it today? Hopefully we'll hear, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant."